Today we're very pleased that John White has agreed to join us and speak to us today. John White's career has been spent as an academic lawyer and a government lawyer. He was educated at University of Toronto, Queen's University, and Harvard University. He taught constitutional law at Queen's for 25 years, where he also served as Dean of Law, as well as at several other Canadian law schools. During the constitutional process, he served as Saskatchewan's Director of Constitutional Law, and more recently, as its Deputy Minister of Justice. Currently, he is associated with the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School and the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Regina. John is a member of Wesley United Church. Welcome, John.
It is a great pleasure and honor to be invited to speak to the Unitarian Fellowship here. I'm a great admirer of the Universalist Unitarian initiative in the world, the initiative of an open spirituality. I want to begin with a prayer. I see you don't have a prayer in the program, although we did hear some prayers this morning when lighting candles. Really, this is what all prayers are, touching our deepest yearnings and concerns, just naming them for ourselves, in our hearts, in our community. We come together through our common commitment to follow the paths of Jesus, the prophets, ancient and modern, and spiritual leaders, the paths that have been shown us, the paths of respect, tolerance, acceptance, unity, mercy, love. Yet we know, these past weeks especially, that these bonds of love are fragile and are so easily riven by fear and dread of an unknown future, and by the unpredictable and savage acts of rejection and hate, the acts that have battered our souls. We yearn for our true hearts to be filled with the tenderness of spirit, the hope of universal reconciliation, and a life of sharing and belonging. Belonging, all belonging, all of us bearing the good heart, striving for a good world. Next, I want to read a poem by Raina Maria Rilke, who is a Czech poet who wrote in the very beginning of the 20th century. Rilke's poems are much loved, or at least have been. I don't know about young people today. I'm speaking of some past era of young people, much loved by young people. And they're loved because they invite, again, an open spirit. They invite a liberation from the channels that are prescribed for young people, sometimes too forcefully. I believe in all that has never been spoken. I believe in all that has never yet been spoken. I want to free what waits within me so that what no one has dared to wish for may for once spring clear without my contriving. If this is arrogant, God, forgive me, but this is what I need to say. May what I do flow from me like a river, no forcing and no holding back, the way it is with children. Then in these swelling and ebbing currents, these deepening tides moving out, returning, I will sing you as no one ever has, streaming through widening channels into the open sea. A few weeks ago, I went to see the Der Rosenkavalier. It's an opera by Richard Strauss, written in 1910. It's about a woman, some called Marshalin, a princess actually, and she is having an affair with a young officer. And the love between them is unbelievably full and intense and important and life-defining. It means so much to her. This may not be your idea of an uplifting tale, but believe me, when Richard Strauss gets through having people sing about this love, it is nothing but uplifting. But the Marshalin is sad, deeply sad, because she knows that this is not a love that will last, that the young officer will find for him a better, a deeper, a truer, more lasting love. And that makes her sad. And she sings, "What fate decrees must come, Mignon," Mignon being the young man, "and time, how strangely does it go its ways. First we are heedless, it is as nothing. Then a sudden waking, and we feel naught else but it. All the world tells of it, all our souls are filled with it. No face but shows the mark of it. No mirror but shows it us. All my veins feel it throbbing. And there, twixt you and me, it flows in silence, trickling like sands in an hourglass. Oh, Mignon. But sometimes I hear it flowing ceaselessly." The princess in her sadness, and I view these two things that I've been reading with to have the same purpose for me, because the princess in her sadness at the end of this singing says, "This is a reality of God." So both Rilke and Strauss talk about these phenomenal human aspirations and human experiences, the depth of sadness, and say, God is in there. And I want to say, I like that. Let me explain. In her sadness, princess notes that God, or in some translations of the opera, heaven, has set this in motion. When I recently saw that opera, I was touched almost beyond measure by the poignancy of this moment, by the princess's recognition of time's passage and the inevitable effects of this on our lives, our loves, our sense of what truly matters. I was touched by the unbelievable, or should I say, heavenly beauty of Renée Fleming's singing, moved by the sheer dignity of her acceptance. And in the beauty of this rendering of human loss, I understood the reference to God. For me, it was an affirmation, not of theism so much as the role of theism in helping people find their right place. In moments of profound insight and deep grace and appreciation of beauty, the ineffable moments of connection and appreciation and insight, we label them as moments of God connection. That seems a good way to mark the mysterious depth of our own experiences and our own feelings. So I understand finding a value in making a connection between the idea of God's love and grace and the numinous qualities and numinous experiences when we discover our most meaningful connections, deepest sense of purpose, moments of enthrallment, and times of finding our truest self and recognizing our deepest hopes. For me, these moments can be understood as the manifestation of humanity's spiritual capacity. We rightly recognize that our soul has become engaged. Or we know that we have been suffused with a sense of holiness. Should we just call this being connected to God? Well, we could. But I ask, why? Why is it not just experiencing the best part, the inevitable part, the wonderful part of being human? In what way does the intermediation of God's lend sense and coherence to our experience of being love, being graced, being connected, receiving mercy. Are these not our human capacities? Do we not know them as our human experience? If we cling to hope in the world, and we need to, is not the true hope that humanity will choose to serve itself and its global home well? Are we not sufficient? I am suggesting that in our appreciation of beauty, our wonder at the universe, our moments of kindness, our tendency toward compassion for those who suffer, we are discovering the best part of our humanity. We are choosing to heed to our better self, our best self. We are experiencing our own soul health. It is what we feel and experience when we attend to greater needs, the needs of living well in community. We find these moments in ritual, of course, the fasting and discipline of Ramadan. For some, in the Eucharist, that Thanksgiving feast in which we acknowledge the constant potential of becoming whole again. In meditation, sometimes, and often just in reading. And I think, too, when we place ourselves in nature and allow ourselves to wonder at its rich and wonderful beauty, allow ourselves to feel that we have been blessed by nature's power, nature's glory. I suggest that being religious and having religious experience need not entail belief in God. It is not God, I think, that is at the heart of being a religious person or a Christian. It is the recognition of human spirituality. The idea of spirituality, the sense that there is a ground of one's being or a guiding star that one turns to escape feelings of frenzy, hurt, and lostness, and instead locate an uplifting and selfless purpose. So spirituality is the sense of deep interpersonal connection and recognition of our most powerfully present feelings, like mercy, compassion, sympathy, like the burning passion to see all people of all creation living and treated with justice, just like the seven principles. The recognition of the way that we can connect and that our best, the way we do connect, through the light of a love that comes without reason or reward or calculation or exchange. Spirituality means that there are values of all people that all people can recognize as good, as leading to a kinder, more merciful world, a world, for instance, of acceptance and respect for everyone's humanity and generosity in lifting people out of need and despair and loss. This is a remarkable and blessed capacity of humans. But humankind is not the only species that has remarkable sensibilities, communication, and capacities. Attributes that we do not easily understand and have difficulty explaining. We are constantly filled with awe as we learn the secrets of other species, the secrets of survival, protection and endurance, communication, migration, regeneration, biological capacities that we cannot understand and that scientists penetrate only slowly and tentatively. Creation is a marvel. Its progress is a mystery, and its true character lies beyond our full understanding. We know more than before, but the largest part of our knowledge is the size of the mystery that we know that we have not penetrated. Humans too, I say, possess these remarkable, barely explained qualities, including the quality we describe as spiritual or holy or sacred. Rightly do we adopt such words of awe to describe this mysterious part of ourself. Rightly do we try to organize our thoughts and insights into a religious frame. It is a way to acknowledge our deepest elements, our ability to gain wisdom and peace, to know good, to act for good, and to love. These are some of the aspects of the mystery of being human. As Rainer Maria Rilke wrote, I want to free what waits within me, streaming through widening channels into the open sea. These numinous qualities of love and connection are what Jesus over and over again asked us to see in ourselves and bring into being in the world through merciful actions, the merciful actions of our real lives, the real lives we lead with children, with the bereaved, with the scorned, with the Samaritan woman, with the bereaved, with Samaritan woman. And today, especially, maybe today, with the followers of Islam, this is what I think is at the center of being a gospel people, of being followers of Jesus. Does God have to be removed from this spirituality? Well, of course not. There's no sign that God is actually being expelled from the human stage. But it is not God at our center of our spirituality. At the center is not God, I think, that makes our spirituality more real. It is not God that makes our spirituality with more powerful and more of an effect on our life. Cautiously, I want to answer two reasons, for this view of spirituality without God. The first is this. The world is physics, science, history, medicine, culture, social organization, its developments, both geological and technological, are all a challenge for us to grasp. Yet seeking understanding of the world and how it bears on us and how we bear on it is what most of us work at and have a little understanding is what, and having a little bit of understanding is what most of us depend on for almost everything we do in life. I just want to understand, we say. I want to discover, what should I do about the pain that I feel? How can I deal with my son's anxiety? We try to use our sense of discovery, a practice of analysis. This search for understanding follows a settled way of enlightenment. Accurate data, the development of provable causes and effects. This is the way that we hope that the pharmaceutical company follows, that the bridge builder has adopted, that the surgeon has steeped herself in. I know many believe that this process I am talking about, this process of discovery and understanding, is sometimes too restrictive, too slow, too often in error, too often misses important things, and that has been true. But in the great project of understanding our world and ourselves, I put myself in the schools of science, social research, rational analysis, and evolutionary science, not in the school of God with its deeply anomalous account. Second, non-theism removes the great epistemological barrier or doctrinal divide that keeps so many people from taking on a religious understanding of their lives, that removes from the exploration of the richness of the soul's potential. I'm not really concerned with how many Christ followers there are, but I do care how many people recognize that a part of being human is making a choice for service to others, for generosity to those, for kindness. Not the choices to gain greatest wealth, greatest power, and vanquish enemies. And I see that choice to be a religious choice. It is rooted in recognition of our soul's true desire, the desire for peaceable life on earth, where mercy is extended and received, and kindness marks the days of our life, and not bitterness, hatred, defeat, war, and conflict. That world needs the theology of the better and the kinder and caring self, not the theology of the vindictive and angry self. It needs theology in the sense it needs a sense of our own spiritual capacity. Although this better world can be encouraged through institutions, from such structures, say, as intercultural and interfaith dialogues, from governmental services that meet human needs, through public schools that celebrate and understand diversity and the glory of diversity, through the stories of the gospel, perhaps, and creeds, and through God. Although these ideas of living well in the world come to us through institutions, the spirituality that is needed to gain a better world does not ultimately come to us from outside, but results from our self-discovery of our own better selves. It comes from finding peace in our hearts and from recognizing what is important if we are to have a place of well-being, not a place of fear and tyranny. It comes from our personal realization that the bridge to a good life is holding the world, the whole world, in your mercy and in your affectionate spirit. Everyone knows that their own true value becomes evident to themselves when they feel love and show compassion. It is then that both you and the whole world have begun to heal. We sang a hymn about this a while ago. I like it. What number was it? 8?
1,080.
Really? Okay. When our heart is in a holy place, when our heart is in a holy place, we are blessed with love and amazing grace when our heart is in a holy place. I think that's the point I'm trying to make, that when our heart is in a holy place, we are well and the world is well. It is our heart that matters. This journey of discovery and healing that is open to all, it is a journey that we know about in our hearts. It resides in us, independent of what we believe about the source of creation of the world or what we believe about how humanity was shaped. It is this truth that when we are at peace and living in kindness, that we are at our own best, our happiest, our most fulfilled, and so is the world. I want to say a word before I quit about why the Bible is essentially a non-theological book. This is not, by the way, a probable claim. It's just a striking claim. And it's time for a striking claim. The Torah and the Gospels are the heart of the Bible that we resort to, in the Christian church at least. In the Old Testament, in the Torah, God is a character like Jove, Zeus, Woden. God is there playing a part in our lives. But the stories are not about God. These are not stories that are told to illuminate us about God. These are stories that are told to illuminate us about us. God is a teacher, but God is not what is happening. When I was here last in January, Karen gave a wonderful service on God, and how we know God from the Bible, how we know God in Abraham, how we know God in Jacob. My view is, what Karen's stories told us was how we know ourselves. In Abraham, that, do you remember that story? Were you here? Abraham debates with God to save the people of Sodom. If there are 50 good people, will you still destroy Sodom? No, says God. 40 people, 30 people, 20 people, 5 people. Ultimately, God doesn't answer. God doesn't answer because God isn't answerable. What is answerable is the idea in that story that Abraham expresses, that when there is good in the world needs to be saved. That the good of the world is our redeeming condition. And there is no destruction when we recognize good, when we strive to protect it, when we strive to keep a place for it. And then we heard a story about Jacob wrestling with God. Jacob, of course, was a pretty vile person. I mean, stealing birthrights doesn't resonate with me as a problem, but believe me, it used to. And he returns to his homeland, the father of his parent, Isaac, I believe, biblical scholars say, and with his two wives. And he stays in the river and he wrestles with God. And what do we learn? That great sin needs to be redeemed. Great sin needs to be atoned. Not because there is an accounting in heaven, not because God punishes, but because we need to be made whole. When we recognize our failings, we yearn for completeness. And that takes wrestling, and that takes blessing. And at the end of that story, Jacob is blessed. There's a great truth for humanity in that story. And what about choosing King David? Well, all the other brothers were tried. Were there 7 others, I think? And Samuel, the prophet, there listening. No, no, he says. And what do we learn from that? That God was whispering in Samuel's ear? Perhaps, but what he was whispering was a human truth, that we always need a second vision, that there is a real risk to conventional wisdom, that we need to go deeper. We need to inquire. We need to wonder at what it is we really need, really want, what our real interest is. The second vision, the liberation from our certainty and our certain path. Tower of Babel, this could go on. I can't go on all morning. I don't know the Bible that well. But Tower of Babel, what do we learn? That God wanted the whole world to speak different languages? Not really. We learned that humans desire things that they cannot have. 2 things. They wanted a perfect unity, the perfect common language, the understanding that involves no mediation. But how can that be? How could we want that? Isn't it the mediation of the things in our life, even the mediation in ourselves between our passions that we want to embrace, we want to know about, the mediation between people. And furthermore, the mediation between our wisdom and our current situation. The people who built the Tower of Babel wanted access to God because they wanted to know what God wanted, but we don't want to know what God wants. That is not human life. It is not our species. Our species is to interpret our moment, interpret our wisdom. And the New Testament with its stories, but what comes out in the New Testament is the incarnation, the realization that God is us. That's it. Or first words of John, in the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was the most human of instruments. In the beginning was the creation, the discovery of meaning through the way we come to have meaning through our own intelligence, our own sensibility. not through dictation from another world, another space, but just through our own grasping of our reality, finding the language that gives it sense to us. And then in the first letter of John, there is this lovely thing that John writes, summed up, God is love, which simply means that the way that we live together most ideally is what God is. There is not other God. And then we come to the great commandments, first of which is to love God with all your soul. And the second is like it, is it. Love your neighbor. There can, I think, be no more blatant equation between what it means to be with God and what it means to be with each other. It is the same. This is what we are. We are here with our spirits and our souls, living the best we can, living in a world. I'm suggesting that God, I think I'm saying, I'm not suggesting that God be thrown out or that God has served its purpose. I'm not dictating to what is useful to people. And God probably hasn't finished God's purpose as God resides in people's needs. But neither is it faithless for some of us to locate our spiritual bearing without resort to God. Thanks. Maybe it's time for lunch, not questions, but...
Thank you very much, John. Okay. Very interesting. I think, if you don't mind, we could take a couple of minutes for comments. But
comments, not questions. That's right.
Yes, just comments. And
own your own space.
And I think we'll probably just have time for two or three. And I'm going to be firm about cutting us off. So.
My difference with what you have to say is you're founding spirituality only in love. And with things that go wrong in the world, it seems to me determination and confrontation, like the ending of the war in Vietnam and the kind of effort that that the left, as expressed by Bernie Sanders, seems to be a determination that we go ahead and confront. And that's where I find spirituality, rather than, I'm not saying devoid of love, but it's different in my mind.
I think spirituality, for me, is the word I would use when I feel I have found my best self, when I have felt myself fulfilled, when I found myself living rightly, living the way I want to live, manifesting myself as the person I want to be. I think I do save spirituality for a sense of self which is fulfillment, as opposed to a sense of self which is just, say, achievement. And so that idea of spirituality is indeed a selective sense. I think that we're fully human with our passions and our lust and our greed and our anger and our sinning and everything else, of course. And I don't want to say that spirituality is dead at that moment, but these are not moments of felt spirituality. They're certainly moments of aliveness and lifeness. So I want to go from there. The spiritual moment is the moment of deep feeling, enthrallment, being lifted out of self, connecting to something that is profoundly important to me. And I want to say that itself is important for the world, that we have these moments. And I think these moments come for us both, most often, at points, empathy, compassion, sympathy, mercy. I think they come when we are able to leave our ego and see the world for the needy place it is and what it needs from us. So I think that I don't have an answer for you. I just have a definition of spirituality which isn't yours.
Yes, if I one of my problems is that with our right hand we preach love and kindness, and with our left hand we go over to Syria and we murder people by the millions, and we did it. From my point of view, Canada should never have participated in any of the wars in the last 100 years. All we've visited is death and destruction. And without going into the history, but it doesn't matter who we vote for. We've got to go over there and kill people in Vietnam and wherever.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about the underlying mercy of war. I'm returning to mercy. I think that's what I'm interested in the world. I'm interested in the living, palpable, ever-present mercy with which we relate to ourselves, to our families, to others. That's what I'm interested in. I think that's what the gospel is interested in. And I am not saying that that mercy has gone in war. There's tons of stories in where it exists. In going to war, in the decision to fight a war, I think it's hard. I think that people believe that the mercy we owe to the subjects of Bashar al-Assad need our Tomahawk missiles. Maybe they are thinking mercifully. I don't believe it. You don't believe it. But I am slow to be sure that sometimes the suppression of evil will cause us to turn away from the instant moment of mercy to the moment of action that hurts and harms. It's possible. It's possible. We live that way. And we live that way because some part of our soul knows that mercy is stopping harm.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Okay. Let's show our appreciation. Please, I really appreciate what you've said.